to the third case of the day, United States v. Timothy Stewart. Appeal number 032377. Mr. Canna.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Matt Canna. I'm here on behalf of Timothy Stewart, the appellant. In my brief time today in front of the court, I'd like to discuss the violations of Mr. Stewart's constitutional rights. First and foremost, I'd like to discuss the violation of Mr. Stewart's Fifth Amendment right. On October 25th, 2001, Mr. Stewart was apprehended under the suspicion of committing armed robbery. Mr. Stewart was subjected to the question-first interrogation tactic. The question-first interrogation tactic consists of the police practice of first questioning a suspect in custody without Miranda warnings, until that suspect provides an incriminating statement.
And before you get further in your argument, the government argues that the standard of review should be plain error, and you really didn't address that in your reply brief. Could you just address that before you get into the substance of your argument?
Certainly, Judge Williams. Counsel is correct that this is under plain error review. The error must be plain, must affect substantial rights, and seriously affect the fairness
of... Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we're on the same page. Go ahead.
Okay. After the first initial questioning and the providing of an incriminating statement, police then Mirandize the suspect and continue interrogation with little or no break. The second interrogation continues until the incriminating statement is repeated. This question-first tactic was recently addressed by the United States Supreme Court in Missouri v. Siebert, which was handed down June 28, 2004. The court went into great detail about the question-first tactic, its motives, its effectiveness, and popularity amongst police departments. The court held that...
Would you characterize what happened here as being pursuant to some formal policy as was present?
There is no direct testimony, as there was in Siebert, of the arresting officer saying he followed protocol.
I mean, this was pretty loosey-goosey kind of interrogation.
Well, Your Honor, the interrogation began at the scene of the perimeter,
right,
and then was taken down to an interrogation room in the police station where it continued under the professional guidance of several detectives and FBI officers. So I would submit that it was a very rigid interrogation process. The Siebert Court held that in order for a Miranda warning to be effective, it must reasonably and effectively apprise the suspect of his Miranda rights. Without this reasonable, effective warning, Miranda warnings are ineffective, and any subsequent statement is inadmissible.
So let me get back to Judge Evans' questions. You don't know whether or not there's a policy of the Evansville Police Department to do the question-first tactic.
There's no evidence on the record.
Okay.
Excuse me. In order for an effective warning, the suspect must be put in position where he reasonably understands his right to remain silent. The court held that a warning sandwiched between two interrogation processes and on the heels of an incriminating statement is not a reasonable, effective warning. The court believed that it is unreasonable to hold a suspect to a standard where he knows that he has the right to remain silent and can differentiate between the two interrogation processes. The court also went into the purposes behind the interrogation tactic. The court held that, going back to the policy that Your Honor was referring to, the policy behind the question-first interrogation tactic was to undermine the Miranda warnings, to in fact de-emphasize the effect that the Miranda warnings have on the suspect. The court also provided several factors in which the court should look to determine if the question-first tactic did in fact undermine the Miranda warnings. These factors are listed: completeness and detail of the first round of interrogation, overlapping content of the two incriminating statements, the timing and setting of the two interrogations, the continuity of the police personnel interrogating the suspect, and the degree which the interrogator referred to the first interrogation as continuous with the second interrogation. Now, all five of these factors are present in Mr. Stewart's case. The first interrogation discussed many details of the planning for the crime, including the acquiring of a car and a gun and possible co-conspirators. In fact, both statements addressed the involvement of others and the acquiring of guns and a stolen car to commit the robbery. There was no break in between the first interrogation and the second interrogation. It was almost instantaneous. The only break was, in fact, to Mirandize the witness. There was, in fact, a 20-minute break in Siebert, which makes this case even a more egregious violation. Detective Nelson was in the interrogation room the entire time, never left. There were others involved, however, Detective Nelson taking the lead on the interrogation, never left the room. And also, there are six references in Mr. Stewart's recorded confession referencing the first interrogation. Based on all five of these factors being present, it seems to be a plain violation of Siebert and, in fact, a question first tactic. Now, we already discussed the plain error. It also was ineffective counsel for Mr. Stewart's trial counsel to not raise this Miranda issue at trial. Granted, Siebert was not on the books during the trial. However, Carter versus U.S. was, and this addressed this opinion addressed the same issue, and it didn't go into as much detail as the Siebert opinion did, but it addressed the continuous nature of the interrogation, and it was an appellate decision that counsel should have been aware of, and counsel knew that the interrogation began prior to Mirandizing, and that should be a red flag for any counsel, and it affected Mr. Stewart's substantial rights provided to him by the Fifth Amendment. And in fact, the violation did seriously affect his trial, as counsel concedes on page 55 of his appellate brief. The result of the trial would have been quite different had the confession been suppressed. Next, I would like to address the Fourth Amendment violation.
Before you leave that point, what was the precise time in your judgment that Miranda warnings were required?
Prior to any custodial interrogation.
When, in fact, did that occur here? There was a handcuffing and unhandcuffing of let's get into your car and go down, and a statement that somebody else had, he knew who did it. It wasn't him, but he knew who did it. And so, when was the precise moment when you say Miranda warnings had to be given here?
At the very latest, counsel also conceded that Mr. Stewart was in custody at the time when he was re-handcuffed by Detective Winters and placed in their squad car and driven to the police station downtown. This was after the
But that wasn't still wasn't just a Terry stop and investigated Terry stop.
It had escalated to an actual arrest at that point.
Okay. So at that point, in your view, Miranda warning had to be given.
At the very latest.
Okay.
And that includes, he was also interrogated in the car on the way to the station by Detective Nelson and Detective
Well, that was after you...
Correct.
And after you say he was entitled to...
Correct, at the very latest.
And you keep saying at the very latest, so when was the earliest he should have been given?
There's an argument to be made that he was... It was reasonable for him to believe he was in custody prior to being re-handcuffed by Detective Winters.
At what point?
That point, when he was cuffed by Corporal Nussmeier after his initial stop. He was removed from the car by Corporal Nussmeier because he fit the general description of an African-American male, 5'7", I believe it was 140 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
After Corporal Nussmeier removed him from the car, he asked Officer Sipman to identify him. Officer Sipman, the only person who saw the robber fleeing from the scene, could not positively identify Mr. Stewart, but said he matched the physical description. At that point, Corporal Nussmeier cuffed Mr. Stewart and placed him in a squad car for 20 minutes waiting for additional police personnel to arrive. At that point, it is reasonable for Mr. Stewart to believe that he was in fact in custody after being questioned by several police officers and placed in handcuffs and placed in a squad car. And at that point, any interrogation following that handcuffing is custodial interrogation. But getting back to the Terry stop argument, the stopping of Mr. Stewart within the perimeter because he fit the general description is a valid Terry stop. However, the increased restraint that Mr. Stewart experienced when he was placed in the squad car takes it outside of a valid Terry stop because there's, under the totality of the circumstances, under Corporal Nussmeier's eyes, it was unreasonable at that point to believe he was a suspect of the crime. He was not positively identified, and the only fact he had to go on was the fact that he was a 5'7 African-American male, approximately 140 pounds. Government argues that based on Mr. Stewart's inability to provide an exact destination or the fact that he walked 25 blocks to get a ride from his sister-in-law raises that suspicion. Yes, it is suspicious for someone not to know where they're going. However, it's not reasonable suspicion that is required by Terry.
Why not? When he says, where are you going? Up there or someplace like that. That sounds sort of evasive, doesn't it?
Well, evasive does not necessarily mean reasonable suspicion. If that were the case, anybody going out for a stroll in the park would be reasonably suspicious for any crime committed in the area. Our position is that suspicion, that the inability to provide a specific destination does not raise the suspicion to the reasonable level that is required by Terry.
Except when you walk 25 miles, 25 blocks to get a ride to some place, you probably expect somebody would know where they want to go.
It's very true, Your Honor. However, still our position that there's no, that does not raise the suspicion above the reasonable standard. Continuing with the argument that the Terry stop was in fact invalid, of course, there's the fruit of the poisonous tree argument that the court is well aware of, and confession that has been obtained through an illegal arrest should be held inadmissible unless attenuated. Government may argue that the Mirandizing of the suspect attenuates any taint in the subsequent confession. However, we have discussed the invalidity of the Miranda warnings pursuant to Siebert, and that does not, in fact, attenuate any taint from the illegal arrest.
You know you're in your rebuttal time, if you want.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. In that case, without any further questions, I will hand over the floor to my co-counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Vaughn.
Good morning. My name is Joe Vaughn. I'm the Assistant United States Attorney who prosecuted Mr. Stewart in the trial below. Starting out with the issue of whether the district court's admission of Mr. Stewart's post-Miranda statements after he had made statements in violation of Miranda constituted plain error, Mr. Stewart bears the burden of showing that there was an error and that it was plain. And if he cannot do that, then this court does not go into the position of being able to exercise its discretion to correct an error it may feel seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial processes. I think it's important to note, first of all, is that ELSTAT is still the law in this country. Siebert or Siebert, however you pronounce it, did not overrule ELSTAT.
But you concede, as you acknowledge in your brief, that the pre-Miranda confession was elicited in violation of Miranda.
That would be correct. But what and looking at Siebert, what we have there is, to pick up a point that Judge Evans had brought up earlier, there is no evidence here of an orchestrated, deliberate strategy, plan, nefarious tactic, however it was variously described in the plurality and the concurring opinions in Siebert.
And were questions asked about that policy? Did that I understand there's no evidence in the record. Was there any attempt to elicit any evidence of that nature?
No, there was not. That was not elicited down below. I believe
that fiber didn't exist then, so
that's
we didn't know
true.
About these factors.
That's very true. And which kind of also, if I could kind of divert just for a moment here, Mr. Stewart's counsel made an assertion that the trial counsel was ineffective for not having raised a cyber-type issue in the trial below. However, Mr. Stewart raised that issue for the first time in his rebuttal brief. That was never raised in the opening brief, so I don't think that issue is properly before this court. I think a fair reading of the cyber decision shows that the court was really upset with the strategy to undermine Miranda that was being utilized by the police officers in Missouri. And in addressing that that situation...
Just before you go,
yes.
when do you agree that the requirement to give Miranda warnings kicked in?
I personally believe that it kicked in after Mr. Stewart's telephone number came up on the caller ID on the cellular telephone.
Was he at the station at that time?
No. This was still back at the scene at Lincoln and Willow where the original stop had taken place. When Detectives Winters and Nelson had arrived at that location, I believe it was Detective Winters went over and removed Mr. Stewart from Corporal Nussbaum's squad car, removed the handcuffs from Mr. Stewart, and Mr. Stewart asked to go into the detective's car, that being the car that Detective Winters and Nelson were in. At that time, I believe that Stewart was in the back seat, Detective Winters was in the front passenger seat, Detective Nelson was in the front was in the driver's seat. Detective Nelson received information over the police radio that the telephone number on the caller ID on the cell phone came back to Mr. Stewart. And Detective Winters said, well, we have Mr. Stewart right here in the back seat. At that point, Detective Winters took Mr. Stewart out of the back seat of the detective's car and handcuffed him. In my mind, based upon what the officers knew at that time, he was in custody. Mm-hmm. And that would trigger the earliest point that Miranda warnings should have been given.
And,
okay. How much time on the clock or something do we know from that moment until Miranda warnings were actually given? And that is that period in between.
Certainly.
That we're concerned.
I believe the testimony was that once Detective Winters handcuffed Mr. Stewart and put him in the police car, they drove immediately to the Evansville Police Department, which my recollection is it was a 5 to 10 minute drive. The testimony was that Detective Nelson and Winters had arrived. Their first contact with Mr. Stewart, with Corporal Nussmeier, was at 10:30 in the morning. We know that the Miranda waiver was executed at 10:35.
11:05.
Wait, I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Judge Sykes. That was at they showed up at 10:30. It was executed at 11:35. So it would put it approximately 25-30 minutes afterwards. And that was shortly after, and the Miranda rights were given immediately after Mr. Stewart made the statement of, I did it alone, after he had made the denials and then the, I guess, it was an inculpatory statement saying I had supplied a gun and a firearm to another person to commit the robbery, which he later said had been false.
There was more to the pre-warning confession than that, wasn't there?
I believe the testimony, the way that it's laid out, is when Detective Nelson and Winters are there at the scene of the stop, Detective Nelson turns to the back seat, says, you're Mr. Stewart, we have your cell phone, we've got your number here, did you do this robbery? Mr. Stewart denies it. Mr. Stewart is then transported to the Evansville Police Department. They ask him again en route, did you do the robbery? Denial. At the police station, they asked Mr. Stewart again, did you do the robbery? Denial. Mr. Stewart then asks, will I be charged if I tell you who did it? Mr. Stewart then said, it was Mr. Felders, and he did it with a gun and a car that I supplied. They then say, well, look, we have your cell phone that was there near the scene. So, well, Mr. Felders had that. He must have dropped it. And the next statement we have is, I did it alone. And then you have the Miranda warnings, we have the waiver, And then we go into an hour and a half post-Miranda oral statement. At the end of the hour and a half post-Miranda oral statement, there is a tape-recorded statement which is taken that was introduced as Exhibit 52, in which they review the content of the post-Miranda oral statement. So the only kind of the, I'll say, statements elicited in violation of Miranda are a series of denials, false statements implicating another individual in the robbery, which are very different from the situation in Seibert.
Well, plus we have his confession saying he did it.
That's correct.
And then how can we tell from this record whether Nelson and Winters utilized the question first tactic in their interrogation of Stewart? How can we tell with the record as it is now?
Well, I think the record shows those were the only questions asked first, and that was the sequence on the various statements. The only evidence that exists in, maybe number 51 was the tape, 52 was the transcript regarding any references back to the pre-Miranda statements, are predicated in the transcript as before you told us the truth, didn't you tell us? And I submit those are references to the pre-Miranda oral admissions. There are very few of those that are found in the transcript. For example, they asked Mr. Stewart, now before you told us the truth, you asked to sit in the back seat of the police car. That's found on page 10. You also asked to come downtown, didn't you? That's found on page 10. When we got to the police station, you told us you were not involved in the robbery. You knew who did the robbery. It was this character, Dual Felders, and you had obtained an SKS rifle from Mr. Felders. And those statements are on page 11. And then Mr. Stewart confirms that his statements implicating Mr. Felders as having been in the bank and in the stolen car, and that he obtained the rifle for Mr. Felders, were false. Exhibit 52, my reading of it, shows that those are the only statements in the post-Miranda tape statement that directly refer back to the pre-Miranda oral statement.
But isn't one of the things that have to be determined what their intent was in terms, when they did the pre-Miranda questioning, what their intent was, and did they intend to circumvent Miranda? So we might need some additional testimony on that from the officers.
I would agree that the intent is an issue. However, the intent was explored in the context of, did you, being Detective Nelson, or I'm sorry, let me back up just a step. Detective Nelson, why didn't you advise Mr. Stewart of his constitutional rights? Answer, I did not believe that he was in custody. Why was that? Because I thought he was voluntarily accompanying us down to the police station in light of his statement, take me downtown. Now, is that belief, is that something that's out there? Is that beyond the pale? I would submit that it's not, because the district court, in ruling upon Mr. Stewart's motion to suppress the statement as having been made involuntarily in a coercive environment and in response for promises of leniency, specifically found that Mr. Stewart was not in custody. He had voluntarily accompanied the officers down to the Evansville Police Department. And in fact, in the Seibert case itself, they refer to, in the plurality, they refer to Elstad as having involved a good faith Miranda mistake. Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion in Seibert, talks about that. Well, what there was in Elstad, there had been a question of, was the defendant really in custody? And that's what we have here. We have a good faith mistake. I mean, maybe it's a mistake, maybe it's not, but in the light most unfavorable to the government, it was a good faith mistake regarding Mr. Stewart's custodial status. So there was not an intent to circumvent Miranda, do the end run. There would be that intent if we had a situation where you had a very expansive pre-Miranda oral statement, then you advise him of Miranda, and then you go back and on the post-Miranda statement, it's a cross-examination to tie Mr. Stewart into the pre-Miranda statements, which is what Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion in Seibert, noted had happened in that case, and that is not a situation that happened here.
Do you read the Siebert case as requiring a deliberate use of the two-step strategy in order to constitute the Miranda violation for the post-warning statement?
The answer to that is I don't know. The court seems to devote an incredible amount of attention to this deliberate strategy. They seem to be extremely upset at all these police publications telling officers how to circumvent Miranda, and yet in a footnote they drop language in there saying the officer's intent isn't really relevant, and then they turn around and they talk about LSTAT being a good faith case with a good faith mistake regarding the custodial status. So I just don't know. I see that my time is just about up here. If the court has any other questions regarding any of the other areas that were raised by Mr. Stewart, I'd be happy to.
If we were to read Siebert as requiring a deliberate strategy on the part of the interrogating officers to use a two-step interrogation technique, does this case have to go back for a post hoc suppression hearing?
I would submit that it does not, because the evidence shows that there was not a deliberate strategy, even though Siebert did not exist at the time. The reason there was no Miranda given is that Detective Nelson believed in good faith that Mr. Stewart was not in custody.
Isn't there also testimony in the record, though, that those transporting officers either considered him a suspect, the lead suspect at that point, or someone who was an aider and abettor, knew who did it?
That's correct. What I'm saying is, I mean, is it a mistake whether he's in custody? Yes. Is it one that's in good faith? I would submit yes, in light of the statement of, take me downtown. And that's what Detective Nelson said. So I've got a guy I'm sorry.
But then we need a district court to make that determination now that Siebert has been decided, to look at it, to deal with the very issues that my sister on the bench has raised.
I don't.
Because you're wanting us to accept that sort of on face value, what the officer said.
Well, I mean, he was subjected to cross-examination.
He was subjected
there.
To cross, but that case was not out there.
That's correct. And at the same time, Siebert is only a plurality opinion. So it's not binding precedent. It's fact-specific. However, that being said, it does deserve consideration in addressing this issue. But LSTAT is still the law.
But this case bears no resemblance to LSTAT.
Well, I think if you look at what was the actual admission that was made by Mr. Stewart pre-Miranda, and the pre-Miranda admission in LSTAT is, I was there. That's it. What's the pre-Miranda admission in this case? I was there. You have denial. Then you have dual Felders did it. I provided him with these firearms. That's not true. I did it. So I don't think, I mean, yes, Mr. Elstad's in his house.
Right.
I mean, that's
I did it is a lot more than I was there.
I can understand your
point
on that.
And the context is very different. He's in custody at the station house being interrogated in an interrogation room as opposed to in his home.
That's correct, and that is one factor for this court to consider. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
2 minutes.
Very quickly, Your Honor. First off, I would like to note that the Siebert opinion doesn't require that the defendant prove that there is police protocol in that case.
Mm-hmm.
Even so, if you look at the facts, they're very, very similar and parallel to the facts in Siebert, in which the plurality held that, in fact, it was deliberate.
Do you think it requires a deliberate use of the two-step technique, even if it's not contained in a police protocol?
Looking at the facts, you should be able to tell if the police, in fact, deliberately sidestepped Miranda with this tactic, based on the five criteria that the Siebert Court provided. Secondly, I'd like to address...
And that's how you get to the intent, whether they did it with intent. You look at those five
based
facts.
Based on the facts. Secondly, I'd like to get to... counsel's argument that we, in fact, did not make a Siebert argument in our first brief. It certainly wasn't named Siebert because nobody had the name Siebert at that point, but we did make that same argument when distinguishing Elstad and relying on Carter. We went with the continuous interrogation theme, which is throughout the Siebert opinion. And finally, I'd like to address the take me downtown comment that Mr. Stewart made to Detective Winters. When taken in context, Mr. Stewart said, "Take me downtown." Detective Winters asked why. He said, "Well, you're going to arrest me anyway." That gives the impression that Mr. Stewart believed his arrest was a foregone conclusion and not, in fact, a request to talk downtown. Thank you for your time and attention, Your Honors.
Thank you. We will take this case under advisement. Mr. Kennedy did a very fine job. Thank you for accepting the appointment here, and you have the thanks of the court. Excellent work.